Feist joins us today. You know her music, even if the name doesn't ring a bell. It's that ubiquitous 1, 2, 3, 4 coming out of the Nano on your TV. Leslie Feist is a Canadian musician who sang in a punk band, Placebo, early on until she lost her voice. She played with many musicians in Toronto, where she moved, including rapper Peaches, with whom she manipulated a hand puppet, as well as with Broken Social Scene. Her first album, Let It Die, was a well-received introduction, and she released the new one, The Reminder, earlier this year. We'll talk with Feist in just a bit, but we will start with a performance of the song, I'm Sorry.
I'm sorry. Two words I always think. Oh, after you gone, when I realize I was acting all wrong, so selfish. Two words that could describe those actions of mine, when patience is in short. And we don't need to say goodbye. And we don't need to fight or cry. Now we could hold each other tight.
Gatekeeper and So Sorry, one from each of the most recent Feist albums as Feist joins us today on the World Cafe. Guys, so it's so fabulously intimate, this, the way this is presenting this today. Is this pretty much what the live show has been like too?
Well, this times 10 in terms of volume.
Yeah, right.
But yeah, these are the boys I'm lucky enough to tour with, and I guess you could say we've been doing it for a while now, so the radio sessions are for us some, you know, completely take it from a different direction.
Right. I'm listening to you sing, and I'm thinking about the story about when you sort of first developed your artistic voice, or maybe your voice, when you had to stop singing because you'd been singing so loud. What did you learn about, does singing softer, is it still problematic show after show?
Well, I mean, I know the irony of figuring out how to sing when I was told to stop singing.
Yeah, exactly.
I know. I mean, I was singing so loud in this really loud, you know, band that was the soundtrack to my, you know, from 15 to 20, we were a band and it was really loud. And I lost my voice doing that. And I kind of started to play guitar and I got into instrumental music and I started to understand melody and get interested in melody instead of just percussive volume, you know, fist pumping volume, which I still have a big part of me that appreciates that. But yeah, it's sort of when I finally did sort of dip my toe back in the water or whatever, you know, it was very tentatively. And then sort of with that quiet little tentative scared voice and also this new kind of disinterestedness in that loud stuff, I started to sort of figure out how I wanted to do it.
One of the things about the reminder, the new album, is it's not to let it die, wasn't, but it's very, very intimate sounding record. And I was reading how you were actually a co-producer on the album this time around. And did you kind of surrender on Let It Die to Gonzalez and say, hey, you know, or what was that relationship like? Because I know he's working on this too.
Yeah, Let It Die was. It's really funny because it's sort of the first record anybody ever heard of what I did. But for me, it was a total anomaly, completely different than anything I'd ever done. The fact of singing covers, I don't think in my life I'd ever sung a cover. I can barely remember my own lyrics, let alone anybody else's lyrics. So, I mean, it was more a product of being on tour with him. I was flanking him in his project. It was, you know, Gonzalez touring through Europe. And I was the girl, you know, his girl on the side doing the matching cheesy dance moves, the kind of vaudevillian art house songstress stuff. And
not dissimilar to being a puppet, as you were with Peaches.
Yeah, yeah, the puppeteer with the sock puppet. Yeah, I mean, flanking people who know what they're doing has always been a lot of fun. Uh-huh. I mean, I've been in a lot of bands over the years, and it's a whole different equation when you're just off in the shadows, able to just do your piece of the music. And yeah, I've always loved that. But with Gonzo, he's a piano player, like a completely, I don't know if, you can't really say every piano player is like this, but when I hear him play, he doesn't really sound like any era. Hmm. You know, he just sort of has this, but I know that sound itself is an era. It's like kind of when popular music was on piano, you know, that era. And there's something about it. And just jokingly, he'd be playing my songs that I had made, my lo-fi trashy demos. He'd be playing those songs on a piano. And it just made me feel like, you know, the spotlight of the 1940s movie, like I needed to have really curly, cute little bobbed haircut and beards. You know, it felt like, who am I when he does that, you know? So we started to experiment. And yeah, it was like, you know, surrendering to that collaboration, because Gonzalez had never produced anybody but besides himself. I'd never really worked with a producer, and or in a studio. And so for us, both of us, it was an experimental in-between tour dates thing. And then it turned out to be this record. But it, as a flagship, it was a bit misleading, because the reminder is more like what I've been doing for the last 15 years and what I probably will be doing, you know.
Feist is our guest, and we're hearing some live tunes, old, new. What's next?
I think we'll play 1, 2, 3, 4.
Okay. Get prepared to dance. One, two, three, four, banjos, trumpets. You must give these musicians and their instruments names. Who's playing?
Mr. Bryden Baird is on the trumpet and the bells. Afi Yervinen's on the banjo and the guitar. Jason Baird on the bass. Jesse Baird on the drums.
And Feist is our guest today on the World Cafe. And, you know, there have been so many articles, remixes, iPod commercials. I'm just wondering if you at this point could still remember the first time you actually heard yourself in the media, heard yourself on the radio or some.
I absolutely do remember, actually. I was just telling someone the other day, reminiscing about when I had my Renault LeCar. When I was 17, I got my first insurance rebate check, and it was for $700, and I went and bought a $700 car, and it had a completely smooth dashboard except for two knobs for radio. It didn't even have air, I don't think. It was just like this communist Russia-style, hyper-simple car, and I actually duct-taped my Ghetto Blaster to the dashboard, but I was listening to 91.1 CJSW, the Calgary College Station, and I heard my band Placebo on the radio and pulled over, and it was long before cell phones, so I was just screaming to myself, and it felt totally improbable and amazing, and I still remember where I pulled over.
That's so totally cool.
Yeah, it was pretty wild.
So it seems like licensing of songs is like ubiquitous. It's it's not really a question anymore. But what kind of a say do you as an artist have in what happens to the songs?
It's kind of a, you know, as much as I have creative control and nobody can see what I'm making the little quotation marks with my fingers. It is kind of a collaboration with the label, and there are some things that I have to respect. I know how to do my part of the job, and they know how to do theirs. So, you know, like there's been instances where I've gotten calls saying, please don't say no to this. You said no to this. Don't say no to this. This will mean this. And in one case, Jimmy Iovine called me himself, the president of Interscope, and said, whatever you're saying no about. And he told me how radio's not the same. You gotta find, you know, I suppose he's right. He can see it from his perspective. But then he hit the clincher and he said, whatever money they're offering, I'll match it and you can donate to any charity you want. And then I thought, well, that's switching things up. That I can respect. And it's sort of like, in a way, doing the favor for the label to give them this free advertising, I suppose, is what it is. And if on the other end I can do something that makes it sort of seem to balance out the scales, then I was happy. I got to work with Kiva, the microfinancing network, and it felt like, okay, well, Verizon, fine. I don't care. It's on TV for 3 months, but now some girl in Bangladesh probably is able to start her small business or something. So it seems like there's ways to make it feel less icky.
And I heard you turned down McDonald's with Mushaboom, or was that yours? Or
that was the kind of thing that might have floated across the horizon, but I wouldn't have even looked twice. So I think that happened. I mean, I don't even remember the details, because it would have been kind of something just to laugh at for a second and then move on.
Right. Well, when The Reminder was about to come out, there was a flurry of stuff about you out there, including a wonderful piece in the New York Times here in the U.S. And it's one thing to put out an album and have it kind of sneak up on people, but it's another to have this raised expectations. Did that affect you in any way, or is that not something you think about?
I don't know what function of my mind helped me with this, but I kind of just interpreted the Let It Die support, which I saw really on tour. I mean, we toured for 3 years, that record, and, you know, across the board, I would always be shocked there would be people at these shows. And I don't know why, I just interpreted that as some kind of benevolent calm, and it just released me from feeling any responsibility to anyone except myself. And I think when you're making a record, the only thing you can be is selfish. I mean, really, there's other ways to, you know, on the other end of the scale, once you're on tour, there's a generosity, exchange, synergy on stage. But when you're in the studio, you really should be thinking about yourself, because the whole only reason you're there is to make your record. So I don't know why I gave myself that kind of get out of jail free card, and I didn't think about anyone except the record I wanted to make. I think that was also because Let It Die had half the record were covers, which I found after 3 years, I didn't even play anymore on tour. You know, I wasn't interested in singing those songs anymore. And they just sort of slithered off the bottom of the set list eventually without meaning for that to happen. And I was really sure when I was making The Reminder, I didn't want to end up in the position where any of these songs, you know, got left behind after 3 months on tour or something. So I had to make sure each one had some seed there I'd want to plant along the way, you know.
And, well, of course, the Nina Simone song remained on there, but you seem pretty tight with that one.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. I mean, she's Nina Simone. What can you say? Well, she didn't write that song, actually.
Yeah.
And
I know that.
Of course, she made it famous, which is, and I'm doing in a way a double cover, because the first version I ever heard was from the folk anthology, the Ship Sisters, two little girls singing it like a playground skipping song from those archives, and then I heard the Nina Simone version and thought, perfect. I mean, the way I did when I was a young girl, in a way, taking these songs that could go extinct because that oral tradition has been taken over by iPod Nanos and stuff.
Exactly.
It's different. It's a different playing field. So in a way, those songs don't really have a chance to survive because grandma's not singing them to the daughter who's singing them to the, you know. So I think probably every record until I die, I'll take some songs from those, that oral tradition, and it feels like just like time capsuling them or something.
Yeah, we got to all adjust our thinking as to what is the folk tradition. Feist is our guest on the cafe. Your parents, although you ended up growing up more with one than the other, were both artists. Did that kind of free you to think of doing anything, or did that enter your mind?
I think just having a dad as a painter, even though he was the most discouraging, like in a good, loving, fatherly way, don't ever try to do this. You won't survive. You know, nobody survives. I think seeing him do it and survive, just having that influence in the house, you know, I think subconsciously sunk in. And I was really fortunate not to have parents who had any preconceived ideas of where I was going to end up. So, they were good. My mom would invoice me for lending me money to make my first batch of silkscreen t-shirts and our first cassettes. She'd invoice me and charge me interest. So my dad on one hand was painting, so I could see that. My mom on the other hand was like, you want to do this? Well, here's the real world.
one of the other things, you've left Paris now. You're back in Toronto. How does Toronto look now that you're coming back? Or you must have spent a bunch of time there anyway.
Yeah, it's really familiar. It's so much easier to, buy tomatoes or like pay my phone bill or anything. It's just the language barrier in Paris was hard. I still have a flat there. I still have one foot there, but I never get to go there. So in essence, yeah, I live back in Canada. I mean, my band are all there, so it makes no sense for me to take my time off anywhere but home, you know.
Feist is playing live for us today, and what do you want to finish up with?
I think we'll play I Feel It All.
Be
I Feel It All from Feist and her band performing live on the World Cafe today. And our thanks to Feist, thanks to the band. The new album is called The Reminder. Coming up, I got new music from Steve Earle to get to, and we get right back here to the World Cafe.